Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and my guest today is a writer and academic who lives in the Scottish Borders and has written a book that we'll talk about in a few minutes on the history of women walkers. Hello, Kerry.
Hello, John.
I should have said Kerry Andrews, shouldn't I? But there you give you a full title. And what's it like in the Borders today, then?
It's soggy and dreary and not very lovely today, but it is still green, so that's something. My official title is Reader in Women's Literature and Textile Editing, which I think is the most wonderful title for an academic who loves books.
That sounds incredibly important, I have to say.
It's just an excuse to read books as far as I can tell, and that's okay by me.
Oh, great. And which academic institution is that with, then?
I'm based at Edgehill University near Liverpool.
Oh, right. But you live in the Borders. Is that?
That's right. Yes. Convoluted family dynamics means that we've ended up in Scotland, which we're very happy about. But it does mean a bit of a commute in normal times for me.
Right. Right. OK. Sadly, these aren't normal times, though, are they? And you're obviously an outdoor person yourself. What sort of drives your passion for the outdoors?
I got into walking about 13 years ago. I don't come from a family that's got any particular interest in anything to do with the wild, that nature, walking, anything. So it took me quite a while to find something that I thought I loved but didn't know how to access. I had a disastrous walk to Top Withens without any water in the middle of summer. And my cluelessness got in the way for quite a while. But I decided about 13 years ago that I wanted to lose a significant amount of weight. And the way I sort of tried to motivate myself was to have a target to walk the Yorkshire Three Peaks. I was doing my PhD in Leeds at the time, and I loved the Dales, and I thought that would be a really good challenge to get myself going. So over the next 6 months or so, I took up squash, I took up running, and I started to get out into the Dales a bit more with some friends. It took me another couple of years before I got up to the Three Peaks, but I did start walking some bigger stuff. And that June, I walked Snowdon for the first time. So that was my first ever mountain. That was not a good one to start with. I had no idea it was so big. So that was hard. But over the next while, I sort of got really into walking the hills. I went to the Lake District for the first time and had my mind blown by the hills that I saw there, and started to get walking in the lakes. And then I moved to Scotland in 2010 and had my mind blown all over again by the Scottish and very quickly got into walking where we'd moved, and then joined a walking club who got me into the big mountains. And before I knew it, I was starting to bag Munros and have loved the hills ever since.
Oh, wow. That's quite a journey, really. In some ways, it echoes my own journey, you know.
I'm glad it's not just me that had that difficult start, because I know so many people whose parents took them up and they were walking hills before they were two or whatever. I was in my 20s before I discovered my mountain love.
Oh, that's cheating if your parents do it, I think. But so it's obviously been quite an important part of your life.
Yes, I'd say so. It helped me get fit, which is something that's waxed and waned with pregnancies and children. But I think the mountain love will endure, and I'm hoping that I'm currently pregnant with my second child. After that's all dealt with, I'm hoping to get back to mountain trim and get back up into the hills. It's been a while since I was able to walk regularly up in the mountains. But it is really important to how I feel about myself. It's important to how I enjoy the outdoors. There's something about walking in the hills and feeling small amongst large landscapes that makes me feel really quite happy. So to have that in my life is really important.
Yeah, I think hill walking, walking the mountains, it does give you a sense of, I don't know, perspective about other things, you think?
Yeah, I think so. And for me, who's never been the most obviously athletic person, I've been really fit in my time, but I've never looked particularly fit, which has been a disappointment. You know, the lithe body has never been mine, but I've been able to get up things. And I think for me, one of the most amazing things about hill walking is it's just a matter of keeping one foot in front of the other. You just keep doing that enough times and you can climb pretty much anything that you want to. And that for me is a really powerful motivator when I'm sort of struggling at the bottom of something enormous, that I just need to keep putting my foot in front of the next and eventually I'll get there.
Yeah, it is a fundamental skill at the end of the day, being able to walk, isn't it? But I think actually there's probably more to it than you think. I mean, it's if you've never walked in the hills, never walked out of a city, it's actually quite difficult to walk on uneven terrain. I don't know if you've experienced that.
To a certain extent, but when you're mentioning cities, I'm thinking of the way in which people get access to these spaces. And I think if you're a woman in particular, cities are not the most habitable spaces.
No.
It's difficult to walk around them. There's all sorts of socially based threats, or the perception of threats. You're sharing the space with a lot of people, which is intimidating, certainly at night. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, that's actually a more restricted space, I think, for a lot of people, and particularly for women. Whereas in the hills, where there are so few people, there are so many routes, there are so many opportunities.
Uh-huh.
But that, I think, is freeing in a way, though I think you're absolutely right, that it comes with its own skill set. But I think just in terms of fundamental ability to access, that the hills might in some ways be easier.
That's an interesting perspective. Tell us a little bit about your book. It's called Wanderers, A History of Women Walking. How did you get into that? What gave you the inspiration, if you like, to write that book?
It was reading Robert McFarlane's The Old Ways that started me off on this. And I should say at the start that I'm a massive Robert McFarlane fan, that if I could write the way he does, as lyrically as he does, I would die deeply happy. I think he's an absolutely terrific writer.
Yeah.
But I did find myself getting cross reading that book with the repetitive calling back to male writers. In that book, McFarlane does it with Edward Thomas, and that's fine. And to be fair to McFarlane, he also talks about Nan Shepherd. So there was at least some recognition that there were women walkers. But as I was started reading from there into other books by men about walking, they were so dismissive of even the remote possibility that women might have walked, because they would say they couldn't, or they didn't want to, or it just simply didn't mean for them what it meant for men, that they never did it. And it just seemed to me that that was total rubbish. That was just not a possibility. Because women, just like men before the 18th century, walked everywhere because they had to. There were no other alternatives unless you were very wealthy.
Uh-huh.
They were walking all over the place. Near where I live, there's an old herring road that runs over the Lammermoors, which was used by women taking fish from the coast to market in Lauder, which is just over the hill from me. And that's a woman's route. So this story that I was reading just didn't chime with what I knew to be true. And I thought, okay, well, I'm trained in rooting around in archives and old books,
uh-huh,
and manuscripts. Let's see what I can find. So that's what I started to do, was just to have a look back at the documents in the historical record. And it didn't take me too long to start finding people for whom, you know, walking meant a huge amount. You know, Dorothy Wordsworth is probably the best known, and she's one of the few that are acknowledged by male writers about walking.
Yes.
But I found a reference to a woman called Ellen Wheaton, and she's written, and she never published them, but she wrote these amazing diaries and journals and letters about solo walking tours on the Isle of Man in the 18-teens. All sorts of people like Sarah Stoddart Hazlitt, who kept this a terrific journal of her time in Edinburgh, two solo tours off into the Scottish Highlands in the 1820s. Walking was fundamental to how she conceived of herself as a human being. So the documentary record was there. So the whole book started from me getting just plain annoyed that men were so... and that righteous anger burned quite powerfully and kept me going for a number of years whilst I tracked down these stories. And then to find that there were so many that had just been ignored was frankly appalling.
So as you're saying, there was a lot of women to write about. So how did you choose? Which for you were the most significant?
Well, I had a particular idea in mind, because one of the things that happens for walking, especially in the later 18th century, is it gets tied really closely with literary inspiration. And that's where we've inherited, mm-hmm, a lot of our ideas about why walking is culturally important, why it's significant, why it matters that people do it, that male writers found inspiration. So the idea that Wordsworth paced his poems into being is part of walking's cultural mystique. So it seemed important to me to not only establish that women were walking, which was factually unarguable, but to demonstrate that for women, walking was as important culturally and creatively and in terms of literature. Mm-hmm, so I focused on women who wrote about how walking related to their creativity and showed a clear connection between what they were doing as walkers and what they were doing as writers.
Right.
So that meant that I excluded a lot of women who would have been super interesting. I mean, Jane Austen is walking all over the lanes of Hampshire in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, but she just wrote really, really boringly about it. She would just say, I won't
I didn't realise that.
And I've loved Lizzie Bennet as one of the most amazing walking heroines of literature for years. And to read Austen's letters about walking, and that was all there was.
Oh, wow. What you said there, I think, about that, in many ways, the history of walking and in some ways outdoor pursuits is very much a class history. You're right. So, you know, the first, well, originally, as you say, everybody walked. That was how you got about. But the idea, I think the idea for walking as a leisure pursuit, something you did for fun, maybe was a middle-class idea towards the end of the 18th century, do you think? Or is that right?
That's when the idea starts to come about that walking is for pleasure. It's not just for work. Robert McFarlane documents really nicely in Mountains of the Mind in terms of a set appreciation of the mountains, that they're no longer objects of plain terror, but they might actually be beautiful. They might be places worth going to. They might be important for human ideas about the big places. But those two shifts happen simultaneously.
I mean, the massive explosion in outdoor pursuits for working class folk obviously happened between the wars. And I think it was a combination perhaps of access to rail travel. And I think at that time also legislation was passed that gave working people for the first time actual holidays and time off. So at that time, walking, or mass walking anyway, was actually quite a radical pursuit, and that involved quite a lot of women in the sort of communist movement at the time who I think were also involved in sort of radical demonstrations like the Kinder Trespass. Is that right, do you think?
I think actually you can date it earlier than that, and I think that is also part of the problem, is that we've got this very strange history. So in the 1840s, 1850s, you actually get train travel coming to the Lake District. And that then opens up the lakes for mass tourism, which involves exactly the sorts of people that you're talking about. The urban labourers from Manchester, Liverpool, those sorts of massive industrial cities that are absolutely, you know, bursting at the seams at this point. They can then get train access to the Lake District. And there's a lot of anxiety, if you're looking at the reviews and the literature of the time, about this influx of lower class people to this area.
Yes.
But it's also a massive commercial opportunity. And one of the people I write about, Harriet Martineau, she cottons onto this in the 1850s. So William Wordsworth writes A Guide to the Lake District early in the 19th century. It's one of the most popular books. Harriet Martineau has a very strange journey to the Lake District, but she washes up there in the 1840s. And then by the time the 1850s have arrived and these people are coming, she's walked all over the Lake District, and she turns that knowledge into a guidebook, which is targeted exactly at these new people coming to the Lake District, people who don't know the place at all. And she uses her authority as a pedestrian figure in the Lake District as sort of grounds for producing this guidebook, which becomes one of the most popular guidebooks in a very full field. You know, there's so many produced in the 19th century to satisfy this enormous market that, you know, she's one of the most commercially successful. And it's because she has spent, you know, the last few years walking pretty much every hill and pass and lake that's in the area. So I think that's lower class access to walking occurs earlier.
In
part because some of that history was written by women, and women were involved in facilitating that access. And just because we've got this really muddled history that's so dominated by upper middle class men who don't necessarily go to the same places or access them in the same ways or write about them in the same ways. So, I mean, even earlier in the 18th century, Ellen Wheaton, that I mentioned, She's lower class. She's a governess from near where I work, actually. She was born in Up Holland, near Wigan. And she never has very much money. She walks to and fro places when she's growing up, and then works as a governess for a family in the Lake District. And when she has time off from that job, she heads off into the hills. So her background is absolutely not wealthy, and she makes an awful marriage to an abusive man who she eventually has to leave, abandoning her daughter, because that's what the law says at the time.
All right.
And uses walking as a way of reconciling the guilt at leaving her daughter behind and the necessary act of survival, because he nearly kills her. And she uses walking as a way of moderating those feelings. But, you know, she's a lower class woman who's accessing the hills in the 1820s. So I think both in terms of gender and in terms of class, the history of walking is a great deal more complicated than the ideas that we've inherited, I think.
Uh-huh. Well, that's fascinating. And if you bring it a bit sort of closer to us in terms of time, one of the women you chose was Cheryl Strayed, who wrote Wild. What drew you to her writing?
For me, one of the things about Cheryl Strayed's writing was how clearly it articulated what it was to be a woman who was walking. Mm-hmm. She talks about her sense of her own body and its limitations. Not least, it's not all because she's a woman, it's partly because she's never done anything like this before.
Yes.
And she sets out on the PCT with no training at all. So there are physical limitations that's going to bring. But when she's talking about having hardened up, you know, the muscle mass increasing, the mm-hmm. ratio between mm-hmm. muscle and fat changing, that she starts to lose, it starts to affect her body. And at the same time, she's also conscious of the continuities of that body when she starts to get period pains. And I've not read anybody talking about what walking was like with period pains. It's something I've done a lot, is walking whilst on my period. And it's mm-hmm. has a very particular set of demands on the body and practical considerations that a man would never have to think about. So to have those sorts of experiences articulated in a book that was really interesting about what it meant to be a woman more broadly, to speak so frankly about her body and what it did to her mm-hmm. and what it opened up for her, and also the vulnerability of that body. I mean, she is one of the few writers who does talk about sexual danger, and you'll remember the section where she's nearly raped by the two men that come across
yes.
her while she's trying to camp. And the terror with which she runs, having walked all day, she just runs and runs and runs until she falls over. You know, that visceral terror isn't something that I've experienced. But again, just that frankness about what it means to be a woman walking was to me really refreshing. And I thought that was a perspective that really did need to be explored in more detail.
Yeah, I mean, when I read the book, I felt it was not so much, it was about walking. But it was really about her. Well, I think she calls it a journey from lost to found, doesn't it? It's how she uses walking. She uses the sheer physical challenge of that and what it does to her to actually sort of ground herself. Is that fair about Cheryl Strayed's writing?
Yeah, I think that's a very very fair and an insightful summary of what Strayed does in that. Though I don't think that's at all grounds to say that it's not an important book about walking, because I think mm-hmm. a lot of literature that I've read by men about
yes.
walking is also using walking for other purposes.
Yes.
So Robert McFarland writes about his friendship with Roger Deakin. That's a really important thread that binds his books together, about walking with Roger and the loss of Roger and what that means. And it's an exploration of grief in some ways.
Yeah.
And for Robert McFarland as well, there's this connection with older people, people who've passed that way before.
Uh-huh.
And that's something that Dorothy Wordsworth does a huge amount of, is walking these paths over and over again for connectivity with people who have died. So I think for all walking literature, it's also about other things,
mm-hmm.
that walking
mm-hmm.
is a mechanism for exploring other elements of ourselves as human beings. But I think the way Cheryl Strayed does that is particularly interesting, because it explores things that aren't usually covered in books about, walking at all.
Yeah, yeah, this is a very personal journey. And are there any, which other sort of women writers that you're looking at in your book really stood out for you?
I think one of the favourites for me was Sarah Stoddart Hazlitt. I knew the work of her husband. He's an important essayist in the Romantic period. So I'd read some of his work, you know, very witty, very funny writing. But I hadn't really known much about his wife other than that he had one. Uh-huh. And then come across this journal. I had no idea what an awful human being he was. Sarah Stoddart has it in her journal. It starts when she's coming up to Edinburgh to be divorced by him because he's fallen in love with his landlord's daughter and wants to marry her. And it's easier and quicker to get a divorce in Edinburgh because you need an act of parliament in England at this point.
Wow, really?
So he ships his wife up to Edinburgh and they concoct a plan where he's to be taken in adultery in a brothel. And she then has to swear an oath of calumny, it's called, to say that she had no knowledge of what was going on. So she's committing perjury by doing that. And it's this whole sordid set of events going on around this divorce. She's being bullied by his friends. She's financially dependent upon her husband, as many women were. So she's in a very vulnerable position. And then she goes off on all of these walks. And it's an amazing account of defiance, of independence, of assertion of her own humanity in some ways. And she doesn't write lyrically about it. She writes very factually about it. Uh-huh. But she's so determined. She sets off 130 miles in 7 days on the first tour. And she documents all the mileage. And on that first tour, one of the things that she does is she crosses over from Loch Katrine to Loch Lomond and gets lost on the flanks of the hills around there in the mist and the fog. And is very frightened. But when she writes about it, she's really delighted that she came through that she was determined enough to get herself down to safety at the lock side. And it wasn't for a little while that I realised that her husband was in the same area almost at the same time. He'd gone off to do a lecture at Anderson's Institute, freeing his wife up to go off and do something for herself. And he tried to climb Ben Lomond in the same weather that she got lost in and gave up because it was too hard, it was too miserable, and he'd just rather go back to the pub, thank you very much. And there she is, pushing on, working hard, coming in much less helpful clothing and managing to overcome the environment she's found herself in, which I think is kind of a metaphor for how she uses walking for this whole period. You know, it's a way in which she overcomes really truly appalling behaviour on the part of her husband. So this whole narrative, the walking is amazing, the fact she's doing all these walks, and I know these areas really well, so I know how hard this walking is. And she's doing enormous distances, which are just mind-boggling. And she basically drinks out streams and carries an apple in her pocket. You know, I like a massive three-course dinner at the end of a big walk. Just basically eating fresh air and a crust. So physically, she's an incredible walker. But the way in which she uses that then to bolster her own sense of self-worth, of self-value, finding the strength within herself to endure being divorced and then being left in a really, really difficult social position, you know, being reduced to Miss Stoddart, left on the shelf for the rest of her days. But walking gives her strength. And I just think she's a tremendously interesting character.
Has this journal been published, did you say, or not?
It was published in an academic journal. Sarah Stoddart Hazlitt didn't publish it herself. There's a convoluted publishing history at the end of the 19th century where some of her writings were published. But this journal wasn't properly published from manuscript until the 1960s. And it was published in an obscure academic journal, so it's really difficult to track down. National Library of Scotland have a copy of it, so I was able to consult it there. But it's not easily available. But it is a remarkable document, and it's just terrific. But that's something that quite a few of the women that I cover experienced, and perhaps why some of the male writers about women's walking are so snooty is because women didn't necessarily publish their writing about walking. Right. So Elizabeth Carter, who I start with, wrote a load of letters in which she talks about her walking, but they weren't published by her. They were for her friends. They were published after her death.
Do you think that's because, a male-dominated society found, in some ways, women walking to be, I suppose, an expression of independence, which they would find threatening? Is that true, do you think?
In part, but it's also important to remember that our ideas of publishing and amateurism are not what people in the period would have thought of. So, from the point where printed books emerge, you've got a really interesting dynamic between manuscripts and printed books. so that male writers would commonly circulate manuscript copies of their poetry amongst their friends. You've got all sorts of people in the period where Charles II is king doing this. This is a feature of his court, is, you know, funny poems being circulated amongst friends. And all the way through into the 19th century, this is something that would happen, that if you were writing letters, they weren't necessarily private. It was expected that they would be read and shared around the fireside among the family. The stark division that we've got in our minds between published equals public, not published equals private or hidden, isn't necessarily the same split that people would have experienced at the time. So there's a middle ground where it's not published, which is definitely showing off to everybody,
right,
but it's public in the sense that people like Dorothy Wordsworth were sharing the journals among friends, and they would make copies for themselves as a way of, you know, maintaining friendships, of being sociable, but within a smaller sphere than something would have been.
So they were sort of closer to what we would consider blogs these days, is that right?
Yes, something in between formal publishing and anonymity. So that is certainly part of what's going on, I think, with why these women were not publishing the works. That doesn't mean they weren't sharing them. It doesn't mean they weren't read. But men seem to have been more likely to eventually publish what was circulated.
Right.
And we've now inherited ideas that published equals higher status, private equals lower status. And that's, again, not necessarily reflective of how people would have understood the status of these documents at the time. So we've unfortunately got some gendered ideas that we've inherited there. But it isn't to say that these items aren't readily accessible. So you can look at Elizabeth Carter's letters. They're all on Google. So whilst they weren't published, they are easily accessible. So there really wasn't any excuse for the male writers about walking not to have found them. They're, you know, you just type Elizabeth Carter letters into Google and up they come. So again, our modern technology has again shifted the balance between published and private, public and hidden. So I hope that means it will be easier to access some of these older accounts of women's walking.
Okay, so you obviously put a lot of, you know, research into this and found a lot of women walkers. What about the women who wrote about walking who didn't make it into the book?
Some people, there are a number of people I wish I could have included in the book and was really tempted to include in the book who didn't quite make it. There was a wonderful story that I found in a book about a writer called Barbara Beaudichon, who has this really interesting history as the founder of Girton College in Cambridge. And the story that I read was that she went walking on the continent with her friend and lifetime companion, another woman, and that they went there and they walked in skirts that they had cut off at the knee and in hobnail boots, which would have been an extraordinary sight. But I went to Girton College to have a look at Barbara Beaudichon's papers and diaries and letters to see, you know, where this story came from. And I read everything that they had there and I couldn't find a single reference to the story. So I had to conclude it was apocryphal, which was the biggest research disappointment.
Okay.
Yes, we wanted these women to have done this exact thing on the continent. So that was a bit sad. I'd have loved to have written about her. She had an enormously interesting life, but I just couldn't demonstrate that that was true. But for other women who really did do the things that they said they do, one of them was Mary Wollstonecraft, mother of Mary Shelley, one of the most important radical writers of the late 18th century, who went off to Scandinavia as part of a very secretive and possibly clandestine plan given to her by her former lover, to conclude secretive trade deals. There's the suspicion that she was there spying for him. So there's a whole load of cloak and dagger about what she was doing over there. But this is not a tourist destination. You didn't go to Scandinavia for fun at the end of the 18th century. And she went there with her infant daughter, the product of her relationship with this man who had separated from her. And she went walking all around the coast of Sweden and Denmark. And she writes very lyrically about these walks and reflects while she's walking on the future that is going to be experienced by her daughter, for whom she entertains significant fears, you know, growing up a woman in a society that will give women no opportunity to be independent, no opportunity to have jobs or careers of their own. And she's very reflective on this. but she doesn't write about it at any particular sustained length. So it's not quite the terseness of Austin, you know, I went for a walk, mm-hmm. but it also wasn't quite enough to spin a whole chapter story about, which was doubly sad because her daughter, Mary Shelley, the second child that she has, and in after whose childbirth killed her, she also goes off to the continent, again, in a very strange setup with her lover, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and does tours of the continent. And I'd have loved to have put both of them in the book, but I couldn't quite get enough material to do that. But I very much hope that other people will come with slightly less restrictive methodologies and just write about some of these extraordinary characters, because there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of women out there walking, not always writing about it in great deal, but they were there nonetheless. And there's this whole richness of history that my book can only gesture towards.
Right. I mean, that was a fascinating insight into the history of women walking. I mean, a lot of things I'd not really thought about. Where do you see your writing going from now? Because obviously, you know, it sounds to me as though you've kind of only just touched upon an awful lot of things.
I'm currently debating whether I want to write another book about walking, and a couple of people have pointed out some really amazing walker writers that I wish I'd covered in the first one.
Oh, right.
So there's almost certainly enough material to do another book about that. But the book that's emerging, or the idea that's emerging out of lockdown, has been a much more local thing, uh-huh. which okay. I think I'd like to write about. So I live in the Scottish Borders, as we've mentioned, and nearby is the first community woodland that was ever established in Britain. And I had no idea this was there. And it wasn't until lockdown and we were restricted to our very local areas that I really started appreciating the space. And my son had just started walking literally the month before lockdown started, so he was very early to be on his feet, and we would go up to the woodland and we would walk there every week or so. And over the course of lockdown, we watched our son become more and more certain on his feet, and we've developed rituals and patterns and things that we like to do as a family in this space. And there's a whole it's not the glamorous walking of the big adventure books, but there's something about that repeated local uh-huh. walking that has become really important to me, and I suspect to other people when they've been forced into exploring the local areas in great detail.
Yes, I'm sure that's right. A lot of people have explored their own locality and become, I suppose, got a lot more intimate with the localities than they ever have in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's meaning there, and I think there's a story there. I'm not quite sure what that story looks like, because there's also the story of the community woodland and how that came to be, because that's also a really interesting tale. You know, this furniture maker who has the idea to purchase woodland as a way of paying back for the trees that he's made his furniture out.
Right. That sounds fascinating. I'm really looking for. Well, I look forward to reading that. Well, thanks very much for being interviewed. I was wondering. You mentioned a lot of women writers who perhaps don't get the exposure they should, and whose writing has become obscure because of that. And I was wondering what I'd like to do, if we can, would be to put links to some of those women, like Elizabeth Carter, on the podcast page, so the people who've heard this podcast and want to explore this further can look at those. Is that something you think we could do?
Absolutely, that would be a delight.
Well, that's what we'll do. Okay. Kerry Andrews, thank you very much for talking to me. I've really enjoyed speaking to you, and all the best with your writing in the future.
Thank you very much, John.